Hey, what you're about to listen to is the podcast version of what was a live radio segment on KPFA. Consequently, when you hear us give out a call-in number, you don't want to call it. If you're listening to this as a podcast, it is already too late, and nobody on the other end of that phone number is going to have any useful answers for you. Let's go to the show. We're going to turn, as we do most weeks at this time, to new developments in the world of COVID-19 and other public health crises. Our guest is Dr. John Swartzberg, Clinical Professor Emeritus of Infectious Diseases at UC Berkeley School of Public Health. Good morning, Dr. Swartzberg.
Good morning.
I feel like we should start with the political news. One of the topics of our previous conversations, Binay Prasad, who is the vaccine chief for the Food and Drug Administration, is on his way out of his position. Again, this according to a message sent out by FDA Commissioner Marty Makary to FDA staff late Friday, which is when you send the memos out that you don't want to make big news. Prasad is heading back to his post at UCSF in April. We had last talked about Prasad for his role in apparently torpedoing FDA review of new mRNA-based flu vaccine, a decision that was later reversed by the FDA. Could you kind of walk us through his background and what we think put him on the outs with the rest of the RFK Jr. Health apparatus?
I can. He has been at UCSF a long time. He's a hematologist oncologist. And earlier in his career, he was a severe critic of a lot of the oncologic studies that surrounded the use of different medications for cancer. And he was highly critical of a lot of the ways that pharmaceutical companies marketed the anti-cancer drugs. And to a large extent, he was spot on. Being sort of a gadfly, he really was a thorn in the side of big pharma, and for reasonable reasons most of the time. And that's where he really established his credentials, as not so much as a hematologist oncologist, but really as someone who critically looked at that area and exposed a lot of questionable actions. He was in the division of epidemiology, or is in the division of epidemiology at UCSF. That takes us to the beginning of COVID, where he relatively early in the pandemic used the same modus operandi, but this time directed at public health and directed at his interpretation of some of the science, and was a strong contrarian of a lot of what was happening during the early and mid and even later days of COVID. He took a position that was much more strident and less evidence-based than he did earlier in his career, and became really someone who was the darling of the anti-public health, anti-science, or excuse me, anti-NIH approach to issues surrounding COVID. And I think that that's likely the way he received sufficient national attention to get appointed by Makary to his position that you were just talking about at the FDA. Since being at the FDA, he has continued to be a contrarian, not just towards science and public health, but also towards the FDA scientists, and that he frequently would disagree with the FDA scientists and override their opinions. He claimed that he wanted transparency just like McCary does, but both he and McCary have done the opposite. That is, they've made decisions without either consultation or after consultation, but making the decisions on their own. And that's what led up to his first departure that was reversed after a couple of weeks. And that's what has led up to his second departure. Really, I think departure is a generous term, his second firing. The issue this time from an infectious disease perspective surrounds what you were mentioning, Brian, and that is his rejection of a large mRNA influenza vaccine study that was really a very important study and that had been approved not only at the beginning by the FDA, but had been approved along the way as the study was progressing by the FDA. That is, they said that things are going fine and we're fine with the way you're doing it. The company, Moderna, invested millions and millions of dollars in the study. Much of the study was done in Europe. What it looked at was an mRNA influenza vaccine and compared it to a standard influenza vaccine. The intent of Moderna was to find an mRNA vaccine that would be more potent than what was currently available. And the reason it was done in Europe was that was where the study was. I can't tell you exactly why the reason it was done in Europe, but it was done primarily in Europe. And in Europe, they don't use the high-dose influenza vaccine. They use a standard-dose influenza vaccine. And the data that I've not seen yet, but the data that Moderna submitted to the FDA is said to have shown that the antibody levels that were achieved with the Moderna vaccine were much, much higher than were seen with the standard influenza vaccine. Prasad criticized this when Moderna submitted their data for approval, that is at the end of the study, after it had been approved all the way along. He criticized it because he said it should have been compared, the control group should have been a high-dose influenza vaccine. The problem was that in those, I think, 60,000 people in the study, the high-dose influenza vaccine is not commonly used in Europe. A much smaller study done here in the United States compared it to a high-dose vaccine, and according to the reports, again, I haven't seen the data, showed that the mRNA vaccine did give much higher levels of antibodies, and higher levels of antibodies correlates with better protection. So Prasad refused to have Moderna's vaccine reviewed. And that's what led to a tremendous stir. A stir is a generous term, tremendous consternation by many, both in the field of science as well as, of course, in by Moderna and pharma. And within less than a week, Prasad's decision was overturned, presumably by McCary, and presumably that would have been with the approval of RFK Jr., perhaps, although it may have been, and I suspect more likely come straight from the White House, from Trump. In any case, I think that, along with Prasad's approach to what are called orphan drugs, drugs that are used for very rare diseases, is demanding for a double-blinded control study, which would have been impossible, or demanding a sham neurosurgical procedure where actually the placebo group would have holes drilled in their cranium.
This is for a treatment for Huntington's chorea.
That's correct.
A rare disease that's 100% fatal in people who get it.
Right. And his track record amongst giving approval to a lot of these orphan drugs, I think when all those things were combined, it became untenable for the FDA to continue this. And of course, there was a tremendous pressure from pharma to get rid of him as well. So He had enemies on all sides of the spectrum, from basic scientists to public health to pharma. So no matter how you looked at him, he had just about alienated everybody.
I wonder if there's any lessons here about, scientific literacy about where you get your advice from. On the surface of it, it would seem really weird to me that you would have a hematologist oncologist in charge of vaccine policy. Cancer and infectious disease are very different disease mechanisms. Like it doesn't seem like there would be a lot of overlap in domain expertise between somebody studying cancer treatments and somebody looking at vaccines for, respiratory illnesses.
No, of course there's not. It would have been much more appropriate to have somebody who's much more experienced with not just infectious diseases and vaccinology, but someone who's had years of experience in understanding how drugs are brought to market. So you're absolutely right about that. On the other hand, in fairness to Prasad, he is well educated in epidemiology, and he should have been able to work in concert with his career scientists at the FDA, who most of whom are just outstanding, to get their perspectives and learn from them and be able to reach a conclusion that would have fit well with not only the basic science and of vaccinology, but also epidemiology. So I'm not going to rule out somebody with training outside of vaccinology to be in that position, but it certainly was problematic when he had so much hubris that he wouldn't even listen to his career scientists.
We're speaking to Dr. John Swartzberg, Clinical Professor Emeritus of Infectious Diseases at UC Berkeley School of Public Health. And he's here to answer your questions about COVID and other infectious diseases. The phone number, 1-800-958-9008, 1-800-958-9008. Dr. Swartzberg, while we wait for a couple people to get on the phone lines, I should ask you about the tail end, the long tail end of influenza-like illness season or cold and flu season. The flu numbers in the dashboards I look at don't really seem to be tailing off yet. What's going on?
Well, just like COVID, just like any endemic or epidemic infectious disease, predicting the future is very hazardous. Influenza is much easier to predict because it clearly has a seasonality. And the influenza season officially ends at the end of May, but in reality, usually ends at the end of March. And cases very significantly drop off after that. This season's been not a lot worse than many other seasons, certainly a lot less worse than we had predicted, or that had been predicted earlier in the influenza season. But it hasn't, as you point out, it hasn't dramatically tapered off. It is coming down. The Bay Area and California in general, it is coming down, but it's coming down much more slowly. It's shifted, as it always does every year, from influenza A to influenza B. So we're seeing much more influenza B, which is bad news for really little kids because it can be sometimes more severe. But it's good news for older folks because influenza B tends to be a little less severe than influenza A. But it is coming down. The data from hospitals here in the Bay Area suggests that influenza-like illness, people presenting to the emergency room or urgent care places, is declining. But it's not declining, as you point out, Brian, rapidly. So there's still a significant amount of influenza around. Some hospitals are now no longer mandating masks. That had previously mandated masks for the influenza season. They ended that about a week ago. Some hospitals, other hospitals, I think, are continuing that. So I think that The message to all of us is that influenza is still around. It's not at the levels it was a month ago. It appears to be declining, albeit slowly. It should be much better within the next 3 weeks. But don't ignore this virus. It's still there, and it can still make a lot of people awfully sick and miserable.
COVID this year, the numbers never got particularly high in the winter. Depending on the metric you look at, test positivity or emergency department admissions or fatalities as a share of overall U.S. mortality, it looks like it's been less severe this winter than the surge that we had at the end of last summer.
Yes, this has been a remarkable winter. Last winter, many may remember, was much better than previous winters as well. But this year, it just has not been from a public health standpoint, a significant problem. That still to say that we've had a lot of hospitalizations and we've had a lot of deaths from COVID in the last year, but it has been remarkably quiet this winter. This virus has not established seasonality like influenza. And it may never, although we expect it should, but it may never. So what does this tell us? Will these numbers remain very, very low? Or will the low numbers of infections, hospitalizations, and deaths translate into a population that's more susceptible because they're not getting re-immunized with infection and that the virus is going to pop up again? No one knows the answer to that question. I think the prudent thing to do is to say COVID is still around. It's probably going to be around for, I'm not going to say forever, but for decades is likely. It's what we call an endemic disease as opposed to an epidemic or pandemic disease. That is, it's settled in and is going to always be with us. Will it establish seasonality? Unknown. If it does establish seasonality, will it be a winter virus? Or, as everybody probably remembers, we've seen this be a spring virus and especially a summer virus and a fall virus. So, lots of questions remain, but even with all those questions, I've got to say it has been so wonderful to see the numbers of cases of COVID being so low compared to those very dark years we've been through. It's been just about just a little bit over 6 years that we've been dealing with this virus now.
Right. And I was just looking at the CDC's 6-year chart of COVID deaths per 100,000. The peaks are lower with each passing year. The peaks in COVID deaths, which are not quite seasonal, follow a trend line that looks like it's asymptotically approaching the x-axis. It's actually quite a remarkable trend over the course of those.
Your comment prompts me to think back a little over 100 years ago with the great influenza pandemic of 1918,
Emerged.
1919.
Yeah.
And
Sorry, go ahead, Dr. Swartzberg.
no, I was just going to say that during that time, within less than 24 months, hundreds of millions of people were killed worldwide. And then it had one bad blip in the going into the third year, 1920, not real bad, but bad. And then it just sort of stayed around in different forms and didn't cause much. So, is COVID going to behave like that? And right now, the evidence that you were just citing, Brian, suggests that it may. That is, it's going to always be with us, but maybe at a low level. It's just too early to know right now. But it is reasonable, I think, to celebrate this winter in terms of COVID.
Well, so the question I was winding up to is, all the dashboards that I have at my disposal are kind of tracking COVID as an acute public health emergency. They're looking at things like fatalities, emergency room admissions, things like that. Do we have a similar dashboard-like chart that tells us to what extent long COVID complications enduring long after recovery from the acute phase of infection are waning as a concern?
We don't have a dashboard, and we certainly should, because as you've many times pointed out correctly, long COVID is really the nasty sibling of acute COVID, and it doesn't get nearly as much attention. We do know that the number of cases of long COVID after an acute infection with COVID in the last 2 or 3 years has declined from the first 2 or 3 years. It much more likely to develop long COVID in the earlier years of the pandemic than more recently. But we don't have a good dashboard on that, and we don't keep very good statistics on this. It's very unfortunate that we don't, because for those people who suffer from long COVID, we need to keep the spotlight on them in terms of learning more and more about this disease and what to do about it.
Well, how much has the funding for that kind of research survived the cuts of the first months of the Trump administration?
Oh, it's true. As everyone I think is aware, the research on practically every aspect of science in this country has declined dramatically, both because of funding for the scientists as well as funding for the research that they're doing. And then, of course, from an epidemiologic standpoint, that is where we keep the data, and how we keep the data. The funding of that has it's been draconian. The cuts have been draconian, and so we just have very slim data. And then, of course, when you look at the CDC, the data that we get out of the CDC, it is a fraction of what we used to get, and so it makes it very difficult to answer a lot of these questions that the public really needs to know the answers to.
All right. The final thing I wanted to ask on our capper to cold and flu season here was about RSV levels, which seem to be kind of persistently high. Not what I would expect 2 years into the rollout of the RSV vaccine for the people most vulnerable to it.
Right. I'm glad you mentioned RSV, because it's been really interesting and frustrating to watch this disease really rise again. We've had a bad RSV year relative to what we should have expected. And I think there may be two explanations for this. One, not enough people are availing themselves of the RSV vaccine. Not enough newborns, not enough pregnant moms are getting vaccinated against RSV, so their new babies are protected because that's where it's most lethal in infants. Not enough young children are getting the vaccine, and not enough older people are getting the vaccine. It's right now it's one and done. It's good for at least 3 years, and it's a very good vaccine, and it should knock these numbers down, and it has to some extent. But this year has been a bad RSV season. So part of it's attributable to not enough people availing themselves of the vaccine. The other piece is more theoretical, and that is, as COVID has died down, we've seen, what we were just talking about with influenza dragging on longer than we expected, and worse RSV this year. It's like you put your finger on the top of a pan to cover the boiling water on one side, and it comes out the other. And there is a phenomenon called viral interference. That is, when we get a viral respiratory tract infection, it tends to give us nonspecific protection against other viral respiratory pathogens for a short while. And maybe what we're seeing with COVID being so low this year is less viral interference in the population and more RSV and perhaps more influenza than we would typically see.
Oh, that is a phenomenon that I have a lot of questions about, but we are out of time. So maybe we'll take it up next week. Dr. Swartzberg, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you, Brian.
All right, that does it for this week's edition of Corona Calls. If you want to send in a question for next week's, you can email coronacalls@kpfa.org. Or tune in live to Call In Live. Usually we air Monday mornings right after 7:30 news headlines on KPFA 94.1 FM in the Bay Area or kpfa.org anywhere in the world. We put a little bit of extra work into repackaging this live segment as a podcast because it feels like the information is useful to a lot of people. And we ought to make it accessible through as many channels as possible. If you can help us get the word out by rating and reviewing it in whatever app you're using to listen. And if you want to pitch in some cash, we wouldn't say no. We always take donations at kpfa.org. I appreciate it if you mentioned Corona Calls when you make your pledge. My name is Brian Edwards-Tiekert. I hope you have a great week. Stay well. We'll talk to you next time.